The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening. Hi, I'm Janice Armstrong. I'm a columnist with the Inquirer and the Daily News, and I'm really excited to be here today. I'm honored to introduce not one, but two of my former colleagues. Annette John Hall is a co-host and producer of The Why on WHYY. She'll be leading our conversation tonight with the one and only Nicole Wisenzi Egan. Now, I say one and only because Nikki's only one of the finest investigative reporters in this business. She was all over the Bill Cosby story from the very beginning. Back when no other publications were covering the story of Andrea Constand and her sexual assault allegations against Bill Cosby, Nikki was on it. She owned this story at every turn. Even when people like me were still in deep denial saying, no, not the cause, not Dr. Huxtable, she stayed on it. Nikki was there through all the fits and starts of this sordid case. And after Andrea Constand settled out of court with Cosby in 2006, she thought it was over. But like a good reporter, she held onto her notes. She put them in a plastic bin and placed them in her basement. And when the case resurfaced in 2014, she went back to that bin and brought out everything she'd collected. Smart girl, because those notes came in handy. She stuck with it and saw the case through to the very end with Cosby sentencing to 3 to 10 years in a Pennsylvania jail. She's written about her experience covering the legendary entertainer in a fabulous new book called Chasing Cosby. It's a fantastic read, and you know what? She wrote it in 2 months. 2 months, who does that? It's unheard of, but like when I told you she's extraordinary, believe me. So now with that, I'd like to have her come on out to the stage. Come on out, Nikki. Let's give her a hand, because this is quite an accomplishment that she pulled out. Come on, Annette John Hall, WHYY, and the one and only Nikki Wisenzi. Have a seat.
Well, thank you, Janice, for that wonderful introduction. I was like standing there next to Nikki saying, I'm in the presence of greatness. But no, Nikki and I and Janice all worked together at the Tower of Truth, the Philadelphia Inquirer and Daily News for many, many years. They were at the Daily News and I was at the Inquirer, but I always admired the kind of shoe leather journalism that Daily News reporters did. While Inquirer reporters were sort of like way up here talking to academics and, you know, officials, I mean, the Daily News were down with the people, which is why they were called the People's Paper. And I think that Nikki's reporting really kind of exemplified that kind of dogged style on the Cosby case, reporting on the case when nobody else cared to or were too scared to. So Nikki, you know, covering an icon with the universal appeal that Bill Cosby had has its own kind of challenges, I would say. You wrote that when you were first assigned your first story on Bill Cosby's allegations back in 2005, you thought to yourself, as Denise pointed out, not the cause. What was your relationship with Bill Cosby? And the reason I ask is I think all of us felt like we had some kind of affinity toward him, whether it was listening to his comedy albums back in the 60s, to watching his commercials in the 70s and 80s, and of course to watching his television show in the 80s and 90s. So what was your relationship to him?
First of all, I grew up with my brother watching Fat Albert and the Kids every Saturday morning on the cartoons, and I just loved watching that. And then when the Cosby Show came out in 1984, my brother had died the previous spring, so I just started watching the show, and I just fell in love with it because it was everything my family wasn't.
You know? What do you mean?
Well, my brother and my father had fought a lot when they were constant conflict, like Theo and Cliff. Only in my brother and my father's case, it didn't, and you know, they didn't resolve their differences before my brother died.
Right.
My mother fell apart in grief, and you know, it was just this warm, safe place to go to.
Sure, sure.
So, and I say I'm emotional simply because thinking about that time.
Yeah, sure. So, the way that the Cosby trial happened, a lot of people think that he was convicted of the allegations that were brought by more than 60 women. In actuality, it was one woman, because it was the one woman whose statute of limitations on the allegations hadn't run out. And her name was Andrea Constand. So can you share with us, Nikki, a little bit about who she is and what her allegations were and how she came to accuse Cosby?
Sure. In fact, that was my first job when the story broke on the news that night, was we knew who Cosby was, or thought we knew anyway. Who was she? They weren't releasing her name. So I had some sources at Temple University. I knew she worked there. And I found out her name, although we didn't use it. And I just thought, well, who is she? And is she in a position to know him? Like, what does she, like, could someone be making this up? So anyway, I found out very quickly that she was director of operations for the women's basketball team at Temple. Dawn Staley had hired her. Cosby was very close with Dawn Staley. And Cosby, of course, was an alum. And Andrea's reputation was stellar there. She was very well thought of, very well respected. Everyone liked her, just had a very good, clean reputation. So then I did a clip search on her to see what I could find out, and found out she was one of the top five high school basketball players in Canada. She was recruited by 50 to 60 American colleges to play for them. She was so good. She dreamed of playing in the WNBA one day. And all of it just did not add up to someone who would just frivolously say this about someone like Bill Cosby.
Well, let's just dive right into it. Let's talk about how she and Cosby became friends and how that led to the night in question when she was assaulted by him.
And understand that there were very few details being released at first. So even the way I write the book, a lot of the details that are in my first chapter are ones I didn't even get till the victim impact statements at sentencing. But what happened was about a year into her job at Temple, Andrea was introduced to Cosby at the Leah Cora Center by Joan Ballast, who was a donor, and she introduced the two of them. And then Cosby, subsequent to that, began seeking out Andrea. And that is a pattern you will see if you read the book, that with all of these women, he contacted their agents and wanted to mentor them. He contacted Andrea and started up the relationship. She did not start that. He was on the board of trustees at Temple. I mean, he was really close friends with her boss. So she responded, and he liked to do things for the women's basketball team. And that's how it started. And then he started talking, what do you want to be? She had majored in sports broadcasting in college. So he started trying to help her do that and introducing her to people and had her get a headshot taken that he paid for. And he wanted, Andrea was an athlete, so she didn't even wear makeup. And he bought her a special hair dryer because he was really into this with all the women. It was weird, who had curly hair. He wanted them to straighten their hair. And that is another weird pattern that I saw as I was writing the book. So that's how it developed. And, you know, she looked at him as a grandfather figure. He was older than her own father. Not a father figure. He was 10 years older than her own father. And he apparently, it came out when his deposition became public in 2015, that he had his eye on her from day one. Yeah. I mean, I kind of lay that out in the book. It was like a predator eye on his prey. Because he says in his deposition, he knew from the minute he met her that he wanted a romantic relationship with her. But he played this game of like grooming her. He got to know her mother and her sister. He had them come to a comedy routine. And you'll see that was a pattern, a lot of the other women, where he groomed their family members as well. And so that's what happened. And then So the night in question, she was going through a career crisis. She wanted to quit her job and become a masseuse like her father in Canada. So she went to him for advice, and he invited her to his mansion to talk it over.
And we'll get into what he offered her in a minute, but I just want to step back and say that I don't think most people are aware of how much courage and tenacity it takes for a reporter to keep pursuing a story when, you know, there are all kinds of people, including other media members, who are not pursuing the story for some reason or another. And so, Nikki, once you delved into the story, you realized that you were really kind of a lone wolf reporter on this, and you wrote in your book that the media were willing accomplices in the smear campaign against Constant. Can you talk a little bit about how that happened and how it kind of like trickled over to you too?
Sure, and I will say, the first thing I want to say is my newspaper backed me 150%, and the Daily News has always been a newspaper that never backed down from anybody, no matter how powerful, no matter how much money they had, and I was so lucky that I was working for the Philadelphia Daily News, because I don't think other newspapers, I know they wouldn't have done it, because I saw it happen. So it was, you know, it was interesting. As this broke, I was thinking, oh, this is like this huge story, and then when I got an exclusive with another accuser, Tamara Green, I thought, oh, this is a huge story. And then it was like nothing. I mean, it was, I thought, usually you do a big story and other media jump on it. It's all over the country. They're picking up your stories. It was the opposite. And in fact, what was happening is Cosby's people began leaking lies about Andrea and her mother to the media, and then the media would run with it. Their place of choice was Celebrity Justice back then. And that founder went on to form TMZ. So I had gotten an exclusive that there was a taped phone call that proved what Andrea said, that supported her allegations. And so then Cosby's people leaked to Celebrity Justice that this taped phone call was Andrea's mother hitting, that Andrea called him before she went to police and was asking him for money. And then they did another story saying it was a classic shakedown. Well, actually what that phone call was him offering money and them not taking it. And that's what I reported, and that actually they're both the phone calls were played in both trials, and it supports what I reported back then. But the media would run with it, and then the other media would pick up that type of reporting. And then I was going on these national TV shows too, and then getting ripped to shreds on there. And then there was a story in the Philadelphia Weekly that was blasting me in the paper and saying we were out to get Bill Cosby. It had his fingerprints all over it, although I can't prove that he actually had anything to do with it.
Well, we do know that he had his fingerprints all over the National Enquirer story mm-hmm. that was all set to do a story on another accuser, Beth mm-hmm. Ferrer. Beth Ferrer. And he pulled some strings and offered himself up in an exclusive interview instead. And so they killed the story on Beth.
Right, because that was the first, the bookers started telling me about how much pressure they were getting from Cosby to keep me off their shows. And in fact, Marty Singer, his Pitbull attorney, would call me and say, you know, oh, I bet you enjoyed yourself last night on the show. Like, they were getting furious. And my stories back then were going out on the Knight Ridder Wire, back when there was a Knight Ridder, sadly. It does not exist anymore. And so I started hearing that's where I heard about trading up. And so they were pressuring him not to keep me on the story. And then he was offering, there were offers being made, like, it's giving up one story to get a better one, basically.
Right.
And so soon I wasn't asked to be on those shows anymore, which was fine. And then after Castor announced he was not going to charge Cosby, Cosby did an exclusive interview with the National Enquirer. And as we found out later, and it was strange to me at the time, and I write about this, because I'm like, he had his pick of all the media in the country, anyone. When he wanted to talk to someone about Ennis, he picked up the phone and he called Dan Rather. I mean, that's the kind of power this man had with the media. Why the National Enquirer?
Yeah.
And of course, we didn't find out till later, and Beth Ferrier later came to me to tell me her story exclusively a couple months later. And yes, sure enough, she had gone to them. They even had her take a lie detector test. I didn't know the National Enquirer did that. And she passed. And then she never heard anything more. And apparently what they'd done is they'd gone to Cosby and they agreed to kill Beth's story in exchange for him giving them an exclusive interview.
Sounds familiar, like somebody we know who runs the country, supposedly. But anyway. So you mentioned Bruce Castor. I don't think, I mean, this story has so many threads of what the heck in it. And at its core, it is about privilege, power, and political influence. Because at the time, Bruce Castor, who was the Montgomery County District Attorney and a Republican, chose not to prosecute Cosby because of insufficient evidence beyond a reasonable doubt. Was there any evidence, Nikki, that Castor cut some kind of deal with Cosby?
No, and there still isn't, except a lot of suspicion on my part. But it was his behavior throughout the case was very unusual. I had covered Castor for years, and he loved the TV cameras. He loved high-profile cases. Anyone who's been a reporter in this area knows that. And it was like radio silence on this at first. And it was 4 or 5 days before he released this statement, which was like 3 paragraphs. He released it just to the reporters in Norristown. And in it, he actually made a veiled threat to have Andrea arrested. I mean, it was strange. And then when he did hold a press conference, it was only after Cosby spoke to them. And again, the comments were, you know, oh, he's being very cooperative, and I'm not going to make, but he wasn't saying a lot. And the interesting thing is Tamara Green hears snippets of this press conference all the way across the country in California, this California attorney, and goes, I could tell by the way he was talking that he was not going to be prosecuting Cosby. She said, I used to work in a DA's office, and that was DA speak for I'm not going to charge him. So that's when she decided to come forward, because she said he did the same thing to me 30 years ago. And that's what brought her forward and made her come forward, because she really didn't think Andrea was being believed.
So Bruce Castor pulls the plug on the case. At that point, did you stop reporting?
No. No, in fact, the very next day I had a story, and again, it wasn't Watergate or anything, but still, I was trying to figure out, like, why is his behavior so strange here? I don't get it. He was threatening to have me arrested for some of my stories. He was telling some of the local reporters that, you know, things like that. So, and then I found out that there was some kind of relationship. His dad had been the attorney of record for the people who Cosby bought the house from where this happened. Again, it was a long time ago, and it was nothing thing, but the reality is Castor had not disclosed that to Andrea's attorneys, but he had disclosed it to Cosby's attorneys. So it was more like, why not? It's a conflict of interest, and it's an ethical breach, and he should have at least disclosed it. Mm-hmm. And then in an interview a few years ago, Castor claims that he didn't know back then, but Wally Phillips, who was now deceased, told me back then that, yeah, Bruce Castor had told him about it. He just hadn't told Andrea's attorneys. So that story ran the next day. And then there was nothing. Nobody picked up on it.
It just was like, you know, all these trees falling in the forest, you know, making no noise. It was the strangest thing.
Right.
But Nikki just kept writing and writing and writing. And to the Daily News's credit, I mean, they were on the covers of the Daily News with a big picture and, you know, a really pithy headline. And so people, I think, were reading them and keeping up with them. But when Castor pulled the plug on the case, it was almost like it was a blessing in disguise, because that opened the door for Andrea Constant to file a civil case against Bill Cosby. And that is when we heard in his own words that he had a plan for Andrea. Tell us about the
right, but deposition. I want to make this point over and over, because it's been so misrepresented by him and his people over the years. Andrea went to the police first.
She wanted him
to face criminal charges, because she was having nightmares for the entire past year. And in these nightmares, she was watching, and she was waking up sobbing. Her mother was worried about her. And in these nightmares, she was watching someone else being sexually assaulted, and it was all her fault because she hadn't spoken up. So that was the reason she came forward. She was scared. I mean, her parents were they were all scared. He's one of the most powerful men in this country. So I just want to reiterate that she really wanted a criminal case. But when Castor abruptly, I found out a decade later, the detectives on the investigation didn't even know he was going to pull the plug then. They were in the middle of their investigation. And then he releases this press release that he wrote himself and faxed, which he admitted was unusual, and then announced it. So yes, she filed a civil suit. and depositions. And then we found out there were 12 other women that had come forward, and plus Tamara Green. And Custer's office hadn't spoken to most of them. But they had seen Tamara's news blitz on, she had done a bunch of different interviews, and they came forward too with similar stories. So there were 14 women total back in 2005.
I want to back up because I did a podcast for WHYY on the Cosby trial called Cosby Unraveled. And we talked to a lot of people throughout Philadelphia about the case. And the people that were did not believe the victims, almost to a person, asked the same question. Why did it take so long for victims to come forward? Some have taken as long as 50 years. And Nikki kind of addresses that in the book about icon intimidation. And can you talk a little bit about what that is?
Sure. And I had seen this pattern before in my coverage. I don't know if you guys remember the Michael Evans, the state trooper, the PA state trooper who was preying on women for years.
Right.
And by the time one woman came forward, and then it was all women who he thought wouldn't be believed. They were teenage runaways, or they were domestic violence victims that, you know, getting a PFA against their significant other. And then by the time the civil case came to trial, there were 30 other women. So I had seen how what I started seeing was there had to be, they choose victims they think no one will believe. And that's at the heart of icon intimidation, is that the icon, the person with all the power, that there has to be a power differential between them and the victims. And right. That is what helps cloak them in the secrecy, because who's going to believe them? But they also are surrounded by enablers. They are also surrounded, which in this case was the media, law enforcement, the people around him. And that helps, and they groom them. You know, they do all these public good acts, so you think, oh my gosh, this person's so good. They're doing good things. They could never be capable of this. So that's a huge part of it.
And, you know, while we were doing our podcast, we got a call from a woman in San Francisco.
I listened to her.
Yeah, we got a call from a woman in San Francisco who said in 1974, when she was 16 years old, Bill Cosby was performing at Harris in Reno, and he came up there with his family. She was 16. He invited her to his show, and she saw him with his kids, and some of his kids were her age, and she thought, this is going to be fun. I can go and I can hang out at Harris. And she went by herself because she had just gotten a driver's license, and he brought her into his dressing room, and he gave her this slushy drink. And he told her just to take a sip. And she said she took a sip, and she immediately started feeling dizzy and woozy. And she said she felt him come over and, like, kind of play with her hair. And she said that at that point, she had the presence of mind just to get up and kind of, like, leave. And she was led by one of his enablers, who was guarding the door, to a seat in the theater, and she watched his show. She said it was the weirdest thing, woozy all the time, and then she called her father to come pick her up because she didn't think she could drive. Now, you know, when you talk about enablers, you know, there's a guy who's guarding the door, you know. There's another guy who's you know, saying, Mr. Cosby wants to see you. I mean, you know, this man was surrounded by people who aided and abetted his crimes.
Yeah, I break out some of the stories in my book, and Becky Cooper, who was one of the Jane Does from 2005, was one of the most horrific to me, because she was just a masseuse that Cosby knew in Las Vegas, and he'd been coming to the club for like a month. And then his arm was hurting. She said, do you want me to massage you? And he said, sure, but come after instead of now, why don't you come to my show Friday night and we'll do it after? She didn't want to do it, but she came. And then they go to dinner. They're supposed to have dinner, and they go to sit down, and this guy just comes out of nowhere and brings her a drink. And she didn't ask for a drink. I think it was Sambuca. And she took a couple sips, and within a few minutes, she was out of it. And she was staggering, and he's leading her back to the dressing room, and he sexually assaulted her. And then she ended up driving somehow. She doesn't even know how she got home because her roommates found her passed out in her car, and she was out for 2 days. So these are the types of stories. And I actually, since the book came out, a woman from Canada contacted me with a very similar story, only she has no memory of what happened to her after she was 15 years old. And I think that's what gets lost in a lot of this, is that a lot of these women were teenagers when this happened, or barely out of their teens. You know, they were young models, aspiring models, and he contacted their agents and said he wanted to mentor them. And then when, you know, he got in an environment he controlled after getting their trust with their parents and everything else, this happened. And then he set out to destroy their careers. I mean, he not only didn't help them, you know, he was done with them.
I know we're just like hopping all over the place here, but I'm just trying to stick to a timeline. It's very, very difficult. But I want to get back to that deposition.
Okay.
In that civil suit, because there was so much in there. And Cosby basically hangs himself, because in his own words, he says he drugged Andrea Constant.
He says he gave her Benadryl, I think is what he said. Right. He tells her mother that it's a prescription and he can't read the prescription bottle. He tells police it's Benadryl. And then I think that he says that in the deposition. So yes, and it is weird, you know, it is kind of strange that he was so forthcoming. But here he had just not been criminally charged. Bruce Castor now came out later saying that press release he put out that night was also an immunity agreement promising Cosby would never be criminally charged. So anyway, yeah, so when the deposition finally happens, he starts telling a lot of stories. And he talks about giving a young woman who, do you care if I say you're here? Teresa's actually here. She was Jane Doe number 10 in the lawsuit. And she's the one who, you know, he said he gave the Quaalude to because he wanted to have sex with. She was a teenager. You were a teenager. She was she met him. She's at the gift store in a hotel in Las Vegas. This guy comes and puts his arms around her and turns her around. He comes, you know, and he says, I want to marry you someday. She's with her brother and sister. And then he asks her to come backstage after, not her brother and sister. And then there's this party going on, then they leave, and he gives it to her. And she said he somehow knew I was this passive person. And she took it, and then he had his way with her. And she was one of the first ones to come forward in 2005. So yes, that is the allegation. In this deposition, he admits to that. And he said he had 7 prescriptions for Quaaludes. I think it was a gynecologist he was getting these from.
Yeah.
Camille's gynecologist, I think. So.
But he was asked, what was he using them for, right?
Yeah, to give them to women he wanted to have sex with. But then he corrected it and said, woman. So he really only admitted, he corrected him, or his lawyer made him correct himself. So yeah, and it was shocking because this was the guy who did the Kids Don't, you know, he had that whole album about kids not doing drugs in the early 70s.
But he also had an album talking about Spanish Fly. And I don't know if you guys remember that, but that was in the 60s where he has this whole bit where he talks about, you know, I guess Spanish Fly was a date drug back then, the aphrodisiac that you put in a woman's drink and you could have your way with her. And he has a whole long bit about, you know, giving women Spanish Fly and the effects of Spanish Fly. And on an old Larry King show, he talks about it too. So, you know, it's not like he's unfamiliar.
Right, and that's why I kind of write, it's like hiding in plain sight all these years,
exactly.
You know, and I have to think some part of him kind of enjoyed that.
So I think another turning point came when a comedian, a little-known comedian by the name of Hannibal Buress, in 2014, he's doing stand-up in Philadelphia. And this was soon after Cosby made that speech at an Urban League or an NAACP dinner, admonishing poor black people, saying how they name their kids names nobody can pronounce, and the boys need to pull up their pants, and you know, just really, really mean and harsh criticism of poor, low-income black people. And so Hannibal Buress, the comedian, gets on the stage in 2014 in Philadelphia, and he talks about Cosby's
smug old black man persona. And he says, he gets on TV and he says, "Pull your pants up, black people. I was on TV in the 80s. I can talk down to you because I had a successful sitcom. Yeah, but you raped women, Bill Cosby, so turn down the crazy a couple of notches." This is what Hannibal Buress says on stage. This video goes viral, right, Nikki? Mm-hmm. And then more women come forward. Does this constitute a shift in the way this story is gonna go?
It does, and I think the big difference was that there was social media. You know, in 2005, Bill Cosby could control the media, except me. But he did a very good job, and newspaper websites were in their infancy, so stories couldn't go viral. Facebook was for college students. There was no Twitter, no anything else. And Twitter, especially, is where this thing went crazy. And I think because it was a video, too, that people could watch it. And Hannibal has said, like, he had been doing that routine off and on for 6 months. It was, like, no big deal. But Dan McQuaid was the reporter from Philly Mag who went at the last minute. Someone gave him a ticket, and he said he was just kind of fiddling with his iPhone, and then he hears the name Bill Cosby. He figures, oh, Hannibal Buress, Bill Cosby, there might be something here for me. So he starts filming it with his iPhone. And he put it on, went on Philly Mag's website at, like, 4 o'clock on a Friday. Nothing really happened. Then a BuzzFeed reporter sees it on Facebook over the weekend, and then she does an aggregated story on Monday about it. And then Gawker picks it up, and then the Daily Mail picked it up. And but 8 months prior, there had been stories in the media about Barbara Bowman and Tamara Green and nothing. But this video, and I sort of examined that, what was it about this video? And this person who said it, was it because a man was saying it? You know, I don't know.
What was it, I wonder?
I think a lot of it is maybe A, because it was a man, but mm-hmm. B, you know, he stated it so matter-of-factly. That this is what happened. And see, you could Google and you could probably find some of those stories and see what he was talking about. But then also, like, Barbara Bowman came forward again. I think it could have, but then she spoke to the Daily Mail. And then she was one of the Jane Does from 2005, too. And she had spoken to us at People in 2006 and Philly Mag in 2006. And then she went on CNN. And then Cosby started canceling appearances. And then And then Joan Tarsius came forward. She was the first new accuser. Everybody, because I was sitting there going, this is deja vu all over again, right?
Sure.
You know, I reported all of this, you know, 9 years ago and nobody cared. But Joan Tarsius was the first new accuser. And then it really started rapidly. They started coming out very quickly after that.
And there's also a new Montgomery County DA, Kevin Steele.
Well, Risa Furman was the actual DA, and Risa had been Bruce's number two.
Right.
Yeah, when the deposition got, parts of the deposition became unsealed the following July, that's when Risa reopened the case, and Kevin was running for DA, and all of a sudden Bruce Castor decides he wants to be DA again.
Right.
So he's running, too. After saying, I wanted to arrest Bill Cosby in 2005, that's what he's saying in the media interviews he's doing in 2014. And then all of a sudden he decides to run for DA again. And
loses.
Yes.
To Kevin Steele.
And there was an ad about it, yes. But he, yes.
So, Kevin Steele becomes the DA, and he reopens the investigation.
It was already, Risa had reopened it.
Risa had reopened it.
And he wins the election, and then Cosby is arrested at the end of that year because he hadn't even taken office yet, Steele, because the statute of limitations was going to expire in January. There was a 12-year statute of limitations on the charges. And let me say, I was completely shocked when they reopened the case. I really did not see that one coming. Of all the things I thought would happen, I did not expect them to reopen Andrea's case because, of course, I had in my back of my head is this case is unwinnable. There's no evidence.
Well, there's so much to go through, and I want to get this through this quickly. Andy has just given me 5 minutes.
Oh.
So let me just kind of recap this because I want to get to the second trial. So Cosby's first trial commences in 2017. He's charged with 3 counts of aggravated indecent assault against Andrea Constant. And after 52 hours of deliberation, the jury was deadlocked, mistrial. So then Kevin Steele vows to have another trial. He does that the very next year. The second trial starts, but something else happens too, and it's called the Me Too movement.
Right. That erupted in between the trials. I don't know what impact it had on this case other than, I really don't know, because the jurors that were chosen said this, it had no influence on them whatsoever. But it did erupt. And maybe, hopefully, it helped the public understand somewhat how this happens, how women will, do not come forward. And in the second trial, they had a sexual assault expert testify first, who debunked rape myths one after one, and just said, you know, it's not the norm. Rape victims normally don't report immediately. Most of them don't go to the police at all. And if they do report, it's delayed, you know, and so anyway.
And five other accusers were allowed.
There was only one other accuser allowed to testify at the first trial. There were five others at the second. Now, in between, there'd been a legal decision that made, I think, the judge maybe allow five to testify instead, but the prosecution wanted 19. They had 19 women ready to testify at the second trial, but the judge only allowed five.
And so he's sentenced to 3 to 10?
Mm-hmm.
3 to 10 years in prison. I think before we, I just have to throw a Camille question in here, Nikki, because I think Camille Cosby is Bill Cosby's wife of over 50 years. And I think that every woman wants to know about Camille. In 2016, she was deposed by a lawyer, and she refused to answer 166 questions. And then she wrote a scathing statement comparing her husband to Emmett Till, who, I don't know if you know who Emmett Till was, but he was killed by white racists in Mississippi in 1955. But she only showed up in the courtroom once, and you told me backstage that she hasn't come to visit him yet. What do you make of Camille?
I don't know what to make of her other than I think that, you know, she's trying to preserve what she has with him, their legacy, not even their legacy, just their... They have their money.
Yeah.
It's about money. I mean, that's the only thing I can think, because even divorcing him, there were all these stories circulating that she was going to divorce him. I don't see that. I think that, you know, a big sign of how his own family views him is the fact that no one was in court for him at either trial. No one was at sentencing. Camille showed up at closing arguments for the defense for both and then left. So, and she hasn't been, he says it's because he told her not to. But his only visitors have been his spokespeople. So, I think it's, you know, she's just trying to preserve what they have. And it's about money more than anything.
Nikki, this is something that a lot of people grapple with, too. How do you separate the art? I love The Cosby Show. You know, I loved it. I mean, you know, I lived vicariously through the Huxtables, and for African Americans, he elevated the image of African Americans, proving that black people could be middle class, could, you know, be professional, could have children who aspired for great things, could have beautiful art in the house. You know, it was a vision of African Americans that no one had seen before on television. And so for that, I thank him. But what do you think his legacy will be? How do you reconcile the man and who he was and his dark side, what he turned out to be, against his art and his philanthropy?
I think they're two separate things. I think he did do a lot of good things. He did give a lot of scholarships and all that. But there's a part of me that wonders, you know, he offered Andrea an educational trust if she, you know, didn't go to basically if she dropped the case. So when I started writing the book proposal, I could still watch the show and separate it from him. Hmm. I mean, I write about that in my, you know, my prologue. But during the course of the book, I watched the All Red documentary on Netflix about a year ago, and I saw Lily Bernard on there. And then they showed the clip.
Gloria Allred, the attorney who represented many of the women. She had a documentary on Netflix called Seeing All Red.
Yeah, it came out like a year ago, and Lily Bernard was in it, one of the accusers. And I knew Lily had been an extra on the show, but I didn't know what role she played. I thought she was a silent role, like so many of them. But they showed a clip that she played, and it was the zany Mrs. whatever. I mean, I remember that role all these years later. It was so, and I was just horrified, though. I was like, oh, my God, you know, not her, too. And then Jennifer Thompson, another one of the Jane Does, told me which episode she was an extra in. It was Theo's graduation. And you can see her in the background at the locker. And then Stacey Pinkerton, who's in the epilogue, who came to me later, was an extra. And then there was the one agency that was sending him 5 or 16 models a week while he was filming The Cosby Show in New York to his dressing room. And some of them, you know, later became victims and were on the show. So now I couldn't, simply because I'd be looking at the extras in the background going, was she one?
Yeah.
Was she one? So, you know, it's just, if you can watch it just as a fiction show, watch it, but just, he's not Cliff Huxtable, you know? That's all I can say. I had him confused for many years too. In my mind, he was. But, you know, it was a great show, but it was fiction.
Nikki, thank you. Thank you, and thank you for your wonderful work.
Thank you.
We are going to open it up for a little Q&A action here.
Yeah, hi, thank you. Thank you for your research and your nonstop living up to the highest levels of the journalistic ideal. A question I had, and you're not a pharmacologist, but giving people drugs to the extent where they induce amnesia, there's another word for that, poisoning. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned 60 came forward. I have to assume there's many more who haven't. Yes. And you mentioned enablers. Did anyone talk about murder? If you give that dosage to 100 people,
somebody... Wait till you read my book, because
that's
gonna die. One, I don't call it murder, but one of the points I raise is that how dangerous it is to drug somebody without their consent or knowledge, and that, you know, is it possible someone could have accidentally overdosed after he did that? I would say I know of no such case now, and we may never know that, but I don't see how you do that for so many years. But I think that's a really good point, and I never thought about it until my agent mentioned it to me when I first started working on the book. And then some of the women who drove after being drugged, and they don't know how they didn't get in car accidents. You know, they were not sure how that happened. So, yeah, I wonder about that, too. Someone could be allergic. Someone could be allergic to the drug. Like, I didn't know I was allergic to Demerol until I got hand surgery, and they gave it to me. I broke out in hives all over my body, and they had to give me an antidote. So, yeah, I mean, it's dangerous to do that. I agree.
Did Mr. Cosby's supposed interaction against politicians that involved stolen art?
I know nothing about that. I know nothing about that. I saw there were some federal lawsuits from way long ago. I saw them, but I've seen nothing about that.
We know everything exploded in the last 9 years or so, but we're also hearing about incidents that took place back in the 70s. I'm curious if you know or suspect, other than the women involved and maybe their families, was there a wider knowledge of the underside of this man? Did NBC management have some sense that they were dealing with a really risky situation?
Well, I talk about in the book that it was apparently pretty well known in Hollywood, not among the women this happened to, but to the point where Quincy Jones sent a text to one of the women who came forward in 2014 and that said, I've been telling Bill to stop drugging women for years. And I talked to another Hollywood insider who talks about that. D.L. Hughley has said in his comedy routine many times, he's done interviews saying that it was pretty widely known in Hollywood that he was doing this. But, you know, Cosby was not targeting women who were in the Hollywood scene. He was targeting young ingenues, basically, who were not moving in the circles he was moving in. So, no, I mean, I don't think any woman who knew that he was going to do that to them would have done it.
I remember Cosby as a football player. I was at Temple at the time, so even then he was like a big deal on campus. Did you ever try to contact anyone in the Cosby camp while you were doing your early investigation?
Oh, I spoke to them every story, and their comments are included in every story. I even tried again for the book, and Andrew Wyatt, his spokesperson, said he would not, and even to just fact check, and he said, I'm not going to talk to you for this book because I'm writing a book with Mr. Cosby, with exclusive interviews with his celebrity friends, Camille, and the rest of his family. And if you read the stories, you'll see they're quoted in every story I've done.
I have two questions, but if anyone else has a question, I'll hold my second one. What lessons learned do you think there might be in a variety of areas? First, what you do with somebody's initial accusation, you know, whether believed or not believed. Number two, how the newspapers handle things and behave. And I'm not pointing any fingers. I'm just mm-hmm. really asking openly. What other things could we learn? Do you see any laws that ought to be changed? The statutes of limitations? Anything at all, but any lessons learned? I'll hold my second question until.
Sure. I think the first one is, you know, and I talk about this, I wrote an op-ed for the Inquirer and Daily News last year, is, you know, as a reporter, don't discount someone saying someone did that just because they're this famous person who's never had any been publicly accused before. But also, I don't think we should just willy-nilly report everything that's out there. Like, Andrea had gone to the police. There was a police report that gave her a level of credibility, in my view. Everything I discovered about her, the same thing. Tamara Green gave a statement to authorities. She gave a statement to Andrea's attorneys. 12 other women gave statements, tried to give statements to authorities. They weren't allowed to, and were willing to stand up in a court of law and take an oath as witnesses for Andrea Constand in her civil suit. They had told people along the way that this had happened to them, so it just shows that they didn't just make it up because they heard it. So, and also, let's face it, one of the attitudes that irritates me the most is that when even Cosby's people will say, oh, these women just want to be famous. Who wants to be famous for being raped? I mean, it is the most deepest, most personal, most horrific thing that can happen to a person, whether you're a man or a woman. And why would you want that as your badge of honor? And why would you have to be crazy to make that up against someone as powerful as him? Because I'm telling you, it took a lot of courage for her to come forward and for every other woman. And they have all been, they've got defamation lawsuits against him, which thankfully some of them just settled and won, but he's still countersuing them. And I think that's the only reason that the accusation stopped at 64 women, because he started suing the women for defamation. And he's got the resources to do that. That's what intimidates so many news organizations too. So, I mean, I think the big thing is, you know, there needs to, and police need to do a full investigation that wasn't done this time.
Yeah, hi. Thank you for your presentation and your book. I have a friend who's a lawyer who to this day continues to be outraged that the deposition was able to be made public. And that seemed to me to be the turning point once, I assume it was a judge in Montgomery County who made that decision. Can you just elaborate a little bit on how the deposition, which obviously Cosby felt was going to be secret and never see the light of day, actually came into public? Was it Lisa Furman, or how did that happen?
It was as part of it was a federal judge, and the AP went to court to try to get parts of it unsealed because they made every filing they could in Andrea's lawsuit. They sealed
it. The Associated Press.
The Associated Press, sorry. You know, honestly, ironically, the rationale the judge used for allowing it to be unsealed or parts of it to be unsealed was that Cosby had given up his right to privacy by being such a public scolder on moral issues. And so he had therefore given up some of his privacy because he'd even written a book after 2005 with Alvin Poussant about lecturing black people about how to behave, you know. So that's how.
You are really an inspiration for those of us who are interested in trying to correct injustices and really get to the heart of the matter when it comes to some serious predator behavior in this country. So when someone like this is unmasked finally, oftentimes, as we know with other abusers, they have a history of having been preyed upon themselves. And that by no means justifies what they do at all, but people are curious about it. And I'm wondering, in your investigative work, how much have you learned about his own background?
Yeah, a lot. And, you know, there was a lot in, and I will say, for what Mark Whitaker's bio of him, which came out right before this erupted again, is a great book. It leaves out the sexual assault allegations. So he got criticized about it, but Cosby cooperated with that book. Cosby's dad was an alcoholic and apparently could be violent and really wasn't in his life. He joined the Navy when and was gone when Cosby was like five. His mother worked two or three jobs as a cleaning lady to support him and his three brothers, so she wasn't around a lot. And I think that really, he had grandparents he was close with, but you know, he did not come from the best home environment. Having said that, a lot of people come from that and don't do this. But I think control is very important to him. Any reporter, and that can tell you, that's ever dealt with him will tell you that. And he says he's only had three sips of alcohol once when he was a teenager, and he didn't like the loss of control it felt. So, you know, the drugging could be about control, complete control over someone. Andrew's attorneys in one filing suggested he might be a somnophiliac. I don't know, but I think that having your mother not around a lot, is even though she's trying to take care of the family, and you're an absentee father, you know, it can leave some scars on your psyche.
Hey, Nicole, my name's Bird Milliken, and I help run the Facebook group. We support the survivors of Bill Cosby. To the gentleman over there who is trying to get Bill Cosby out, you do not want to be friends with, well, yeah, we are, yeah, you probably just want to stay away from me tonight. A couple of things, Nicole. One, I'm hoping there's a screenplay or something, you know, a movie or talks or a movie are in the works. I think it's really interesting that the people who are present here tonight, you know, most of the people who are commenting are white men. You know, you'd think there'd be a lot of women here supporting you and speaking up, but I think this is like this, the demographic here kind of speaks to, you know, our larger society picture of who feels empowered to have a voice. Or just even the presence of non-white people here, you know, it's very telling. As you probably know, Nicole, I was very, very active outside the courthouse during the trial, and I tried very hard to get attention from the media, and it didn't happen. And I did some very outlandish things, and I'm wondering, do you have any ideas of what people who are activists, who are trying to speak out for women, who are trying to make a difference, what could I or people be doing differently to get media attention, to shift the focus away from supporting people like Bill Cosby to reflecting support for the women who are coming forward?
Well, I mean, honestly, I think, you know, putting statements, like I was noticing, like, Cosby's controlling the microphone again, right? Every time Andrew Wyatt releases a statement or whatever, it's headlines everywhere. The DA's office isn't talking. Andrew's attorneys aren't talking. Some reporters, like the New York Daily News last week, went to Lily Bernard and got a quote and a reaction. But instead, you know, the headlines are all, Bill Cosby says judge is racist, or Bill Cosby says this, Bill Cosby says that. So if I were you, I would start putting out statements on your social media in response from We Support the Survivors of Bill Cosby in response. Send it to the media and see if they'll start including it. And I think you've just got to, there needs to be another voice in these stories, and there isn't right now.
Thank you for what you've done for a lot of survivors of sexual assault. I am one of them, and I also was assaulted and abused and groomed previously by the father figure, by my spiritual father, by a priest, and he's still out there doing the same thing. So this is very dear and near. I'm a recent graduate of WAR, which stands for Women Organized Against Rape. And it's the first and the only crisis center for those who are abused. I wanted to ask you to tell us how the grooming process happens. And as people noted that, you know, like, the predator does not just groom the victim, but also the public.
You know, I'm not an expert, I will first say that, but I will say that the pattern is that it's people who already are in positions of authority or of respect, priests, coaches, Boy Scout leaders, comedians who are beloved. Jerry Sandusky, he adopted at-risk, he adopted foster kids, and he started a foundation to help foster kids.
I jump in and say Jerry Sandusky was an assistant football coach at
Oh, sorry.
Penn State.
I just
under Joe Paterno.
And so, you know, what they do is they, and this is in the book too, they're very nice. They shower the person with attention. They shower them with gifts. They shower them with, I want to help you. And they see what kind of response they get. And especially when it's with children, they will, if they get a certain response, they will leave that child alone. Like they know who to target. And then they like Cosby would say, we'd call and say, I want to talk to your mother, and we'd get on the phone with the mother. He'd come over to dinner, the grandmother fixed them soul food, and he brought Jell-O pudding pops for the neighborhood. The one girl, Shaylan, who was crying through her testimony at the second trial said. So it's just a very, it's a show. It's like they're warm and nice and showering you with attention and showering your family with attention. And they already have this cloak of respectability around them. So you have no reason to suspect that they're anything but what they say.
We're going to
what happens.
Oh, sorry.
That's okay. Sorry.
We're going to take our last question right there.
Oh.
Nicole and Annette as well, thank you very much. I mean, this it's amazing what a trigger this evening was. I think it was a word that was used before. In my sense of trigger is perhaps different from the drama that the woman described what happened to her. But this remains for me an unbelievable story. The number of close calls in which he came so extremely close to evading the justice that ultimately was served. You know, remembering, for instance, that there was a first trial and he beat it, and then the prosecutor, it all comes back. And I remember for myself, I mean, I remember the tension I felt on those days when the jury was deliberating, you know, both for the first trial and the second trial. So for me, it remains just an amazing story. But there was one particular thing I wanted to ask you. You, I think part of the reason it is an amazing story is it's sitting on top of all that reporting you did for so long. As a Philadelphian, I read it. I've been reading your byline for 20 years, but it didn't go anywhere. And that phase that you described, where he re-entered the public eye, and now he was a moralist, you know, even after your reporting. So I remain particularly intrigued by that period, sort of post the comedian, and I remember all of that vividly. I remember that weekend, and suddenly there was all this chatter, and Twitter in particular. But then about a three-month period after that, where I was now seeing sort of aggregated national stories that were weaving together all that you had been reporting all along. Could you just describe, as a local reporter who was in the trenches, how important was that national piece to give a lift to the story and have it reemerge as it did?
Oh, it was crucial. It was crucial, and it wasn't just national. It was everywhere. All of a sudden, there were hundreds of reporters on it. It was crucial, and it just wouldn't go away. It was like headlines every day. So it was crucial. But I will, and the more media coverage there was, I think the more other women felt comfortable coming forward, and it led to more and more accusers coming forward. And I write about that in the book, because I said, you know, what if in 2005 all the media hadn't backed off? What if the media had stayed on it? Maybe more women, 12 other women, 13 other women came forward back then. There might have been more. If the DA had done a full investigation back then, too, there might have been more. So I think the media attention was crucial, because it made the women feel comfortable about coming forward and telling their stories. You know, there's safety in numbers to a certain extent. Some of them weren't even, they had no memory of what happened to them. The last thing they knew was their mentor, their you know, America's dad had given them a drink, and they didn't even know anything was in it, and then they wake up 2 days later, and they're not sure what happened. So some of those women who came forward just didn't know anything had happened to them, because they had no memory of it, and then started hearing these other stories and are like, oh my God, that must have been what happened to me. So I think it's crucial.
Nikki Weiss and C. Egan, I mean, you make me proud to be part of this profession. Give her a hand. Thank you so much for being here, the work you did.
Thank you.
The work you continue to do.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.